Grab your Bible and make your way over to Matthew chapter 15, which is our reading for this week as we make our way through the Gospels. I guess we're a little bit more than halfway through Matthew now.
Chapter 14 and chapter 15. This is the turning point.
Here we go.
In terms of numbers.
It's amazing how quickly it gets away from us.
I know.
So one of the more familiar chapters, I think, in the Gospel of Matthew. Just to big picture this for you, we start out with this encounter with Pharisees, which I think illustrates the depth of their unbelief, as well as some wishy-washiness on the part of the disciples in the aftermath of that, all of which is in contrast with this Canaanite woman we encounter in the middle of the chapter,
right,
who would be, by perception of that time, an outsider who has great faith in Jesus and will be undeterred from getting him to grant her request.
Right.
And then that's followed by another feeding story at the end of the chapter in which, again, the disciples look a little wishy-washy. You know, there's only a little bit of food. What can we do? You think right. by now they would have that figured out, right?
Right.
So he was walking
on water last chapter.
Yeah,
so.
you end up with kind of three categories of people. You have
right.
those who are staunchly unbelieving.
Right, Pharisees.
On the other end of that, you have this Canaanite woman who is staunchly believing. She's
right.
all in unexpectedly. And then you have the disciples who are kind of vacillating. They're kind of in the middle. They're kind of back and forth. And so you kind of have the parable of the sower that we encountered, chapter two back?
13.
Yeah, 13.
Yeah, back in 13.
The parable of the sower being played out
yeah.
In the hearts of these disciples that are represented here. So it's still kind of what we were talking about in 14. It's a lot about miracles, and it's a lot about heart. And if you actually
yeah.
watch for heart in chapter 15, that comes up again and again, which seems to be part of his focus here.
And then back to the Sermon on the Mount, for that matter, when Jesus first taught that real righteousness comes out of the heart, not just the actions. So,
yeah. yeah.
That's a big
10,000-foot view of the chapter. Those are the episodes we're
yeah.
dealing with.
Yeah. So, you know, you already mentioned, taking us back to chapter 13, that's where Jesus, you know, gives some new teaching about, you know, the heart and reception of the word, which also means to receive him and his teaching. Mm-hmm. Just like in the Sermon on the Mount, ended with a warning about accepting or not accepting his teaching. And so now we have stories of Jesus' actions and interactions involving who's receiving him and his teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And this really, I mean, again, you know, chapter breaks are unfortunate. But this whole section's from 13, you know, up into where we're at right now, and even in the 16, you know, the coming chapters, you know, these actions and interactions playing out reception of Jesus, listening to his teaching, along with, you know, continued issues of righteousness, one of the great themes of the book.
It'd be a good suggestion, I think, to make to the audience to go back and read at least 13 through 16 as a unit. Just
yeah.
sit down and read the whole thing together and watch for these ideas, different people and how they're reacting to Jesus and what it says about
yeah.
his heart. Again, not to be limited by those chapter divisions, from kind of seeing the idea that he's weaving all the way through this segment.
Right. You know, and so just like last week when we talked about chapter 14, I mean, the irony is the first one to confess he's wrestling a little bit with who is Jesus really is John the Baptist. You know, and then, of course, he's you know, that was actually back a little bit earlier in chapter 14, to be fair, but he dies as an ominous foreshadowing.
Right.
So then Jesus works a couple of, does a couple of great signs, and we talked about the feeding, and the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000 this week, you know, kind of bookend what's going on in between.
Right.
You have these two great creation miracles where Jesus makes something out of not exactly nothing this time, but he clearly makes more out of less in a very godlike way. Coupled with that walking on water, which was a Yahweh, a God miracle. And so now you have the Pharisees coming in again saying, you can't be the guy, basically, because you're breaking tradition. That's what they're implying or hinting.
Which, by the way, if I could just interject.
Yeah, yeah.
The contrast in that is so sharp.
Right.
Walking on water.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we've got this issue with your disciples washing their hands.
Right.
You know? And the pettiness of one versus the magnitude of the others I think it's really sharp here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so to that end, you know, Jesus quotes some more Isaiah against them, you know, Isaiah 29 mm-hmm. this time, just like he quoted Isaiah chapter 6 back in Matthew 13 about the parables and, you know, you're not going to see. You know, right. It's a test of the heart for those who don't want to see. And in the context of Isaiah 29, the verses that Jesus pulled, you still have in that larger context God again through Isaiah back then saying, you don't see. You don't see, you know, this vain worship and these human traditions are substitute surrogates that you think make you righteous, but you really don't see me and who I am and what I want, really. And so then that leads Jesus to then talk about, he doesn't use the word righteousness, but what real righteousness is. It's not about external actions alone. You do have to, you know, you can't fornicate. I mean, you know, you can't be idolatrous. He's not saying the actions don't matter, but what he is saying is, it starts from the heart out, or you know, and that's where it works. And as a concrete example, then that woman, it's not just any woman, it's a Canaanite woman, you know, a Syrophoenician woman in other gospels. And so here, what you have now is a woman who is ceremonially traditionally unclean as a Gentile woman, who ironically Jesus says has faith. She's the one with a righteousness. She's the one who the word has taken root in. She's the one who knows who he is in a sense, unlike everybody else around him. And so just to drive the point home, it starts in the heart, doesn't excuse actions, and actions are not completely out of the picture. But without the heart, the actions do not matter. And Jesus says this woman who's, you know, according to not just the law but your traditions, is an outsider, to use one of your favorite terms. Jesus says actually, no, she's healed. She and her daughter, you know, her daughter's healed. This is exactly what I'm looking for.
Which, by the way, this idea that true righteousness grows out of the heart into the actions,
yeah,
is an idea he's been working since the Sermon on the Mount.
Correct.
You know, early in Matthew 5.
That's right.
That is so much, as he's correcting misunderstandings of the law, that's so much of what he emphasizes,
yeah,
is you're trying to check boxes on the outside. And not saying it's not important,
right,
to check the boxes on the outside,
right,
but it ought to grow from what is in you,
right,
not just some kind of checklist religion.
Right.
And they're missing that point. And again, coming back to that over and over again throughout,
right,
this segment.
And of course, part of, you know, what Jesus may be foreshadowing as well, as, you know, with his ministry, with the kingdom he's come to launch, you know, your adherence to Moses, which would have told her she's out, maybe not ethically, but ceremonially she's out, unless she wants to proselytize and convert, you know, and so forth. You know, in the kingdom that's coming, you know, Moses doesn't matter. You know, the question of what you do with Moses no longer matters. The question of what you do with Jesus. And that's why she's on the cutting edge, and they're the ones being left behind.
Yeah. By the way, I think we ought to say about that story, I think people would read that, and their knee jerk would be to think that Jesus is being mean to her.
Yeah.
And I think just the opposite is true.
Yeah.
Remember, at the end of John 2, we're told that Jesus knows what is in man.
Yeah.
And I think that Jesus is trying to draw her out by being slow in acknowledging her faith, because he wants people to see this. He wants to put her on display. And so it isn't meanness here. It's actually how impressed he is with her great faith and wanting to use her as an example. I think that's really what's going on in the context.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I think you may be the one who, you know, other times has pointed out, you know, just that, you know, faith maturity comes through struggle, not through easy moves. And so Jesus is not, you know, saying, Jesus is not ultimately saying no to her. He's pushing her to come to a deeper, if nothing else, a deeper realization and confession. He's forcing her to flex her faith a little bit more, in a way that will do her good. And because certainly, you know, Jesus does grant her request, the demon is cast out. And again, it's interesting that, you know, in all this language of healing, where we got, you know, 14 healing, we got some more, you know, healing right after the story of the woman here, you know, that the healings in the Gospels, so often, even when there are literal physical healings, it's a metaphor for the spiritual reality. And what the woman gets is, you know, the demon, you know, Satan, sin, death, that's what's driven away. And I think that's poignant too in her faith. You know, she's not wanting, you know, a big house and $1 million. She wants spiritual health for her and her daughter.
Yeah, the other thing I think is interesting about this, and I think about the man who is healed in John 9, the blind man, and I kind of see similarities between these two, because there is a simplicity to their faith.
Yeah.
The blind man's argument is, I couldn't see, and he gave me sight.
Right.
What don't you get about that?
Right, right.
Right?
One thing I know.
Yeah, one thing I know. He may not have been a deeply theologically trained man.
Yeah.
In fact, the religious authorities are kind of dismissive of him for that reason.
Because he's not learning in their ways.
Yeah. We know, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's saying, well, look, maybe you do, but... And I think this woman clearly recognizes the power of Jesus to heal her daughter, and so she's unrelenting in her pursuit of it. He's got the answer, and I need to get him to do that. And so the Pharisees, I think, because of their corrupt hearts, are blinded by their own traditions and their own views of the law from being able to see that. They have complicated what was very, very simple. How do you see a man raised from the dead,
right,
and not be impressed with the man who raised him?
Well, exactly.
It's simple, and sometimes in the way they've made the whole process complicated, they're missing it.
Well, and what's funny is when you bring up the blind man along with this woman here, this Canaanite woman here, is in both cases the people who see the clearest are the ones who are least caught up and invested in the status quo, and that's probably a warning for us too. Again, that the more you get comfortable in life and the way things are, you don't want Jesus to change the status quo, because Jesus does mess with your life. And so,
yes.
This Canaanite woman is not invested in all these traditions, and this is the way we do things. This is our culture, our heritage, our ancestors. She's not invested in all of that. She just knows, or sees in Jesus, he's the son of David in the way we've been waiting for, looking for. And even though I'm not Jewish, I know the son of David's, going to do great things, and I want in on that. And the same thing with the blind man. As a blind man, he's an outsider. He may be Jewish, but he's one of the other reasons everyone's so dismissive of him, he's sitting outside begging alms. He's not invested in the status quo. And so the more we get comfortable in the world and in life, there's always a danger that we won't want to make the changes that have to be made.
And the flip side of that, to put balance on that, is just because something is heritage and tradition and been believed a long time doesn't necessarily make it suspect.
Correct.
The point is, we are devoted to Jesus,
right,
and not to our traditions. And if traditions are derived from Jesus, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But I think that we need to constantly be going back to Jesus,
yeah,
and drawing everything we say, everything we do from him as our authority, to be sure we stay on that track,
right,
because that's the important thing.
Well, and even that word tradition gets people tripped up, and obviously that's a big word in this chapter too. And, tradition literally just means something that's handed down. And so, everything is tradition that comes from the past, and this is because it's been handed down in the most technical sense. That's why Paul in 2 Thessalonians will talk about, in a positive way, the traditions, stick with the traditions,
right,
what has been handed
exactly
down. So the real issue is not that something comes from the past and is quote-unquote traditional. The real question is, who handed it down first? Did it come from Jesus and the apostles, which is what we now call the New Testament, or is it something that, again, is our custom, our habit of doing things? And so it came down not from Jesus and God and the apostles. It came down because of custom, convenience, habit, what have you.
Yeah.
But just because something is old, you're right. I mean, that's the thing. Just because something is old, there may be a good reason, a good authoritative reason.
It's been around for a while.
For why we are, that's exactly right. So we have to be discerning about, just not writing stuff off because it's traditional.
Right. Let's say a word about the disciples, because because I think even the disciples here kind of look like they're behind when you compare them with this Canaanite woman who is just so rock solid. Hey, you can do this. I'm all in.
Yeah.
And even after, I mean, we're dealing with almost a repeat miracle at the end of chapter 15.
Yeah, with the 4,000.
And in verse 33, this is 15:33, where are we to get so many loaves in this desolate place to satisfy a large crowd? It's like they're still not quite there yet. They're struggling to figure out who he is. And that will become even more vivid moving ahead. Watch for this when we get to 16 next week, because we're going to see that again with Peter.
Well, and it's not just them, because obviously, and this is not just something done for the disciples. This is something done very publicly for a multitude, 5,000, 4,000. And so, you know, the interesting thing too is, you know, it's like, you know, do a sign, very public sign. Walking on water was for the disciples. You know, the multitude was public. You know, and so you do that. We have this interaction with the Pharisees, who, you know, and then he does the feeding again, kind of, you know, do you hear me now? Do you see me now? Kind of stuff. But then literally the very first couple of verses of chapter 16, not to give too much away for next week, then you have the Pharisees coming back and saying, okay, we need a sign.
Right, right.
You know, that
it's
was,
never enough.
It could be, and that's what Matthew, and the way Matthew wants to tell us the story by the Spirit's inspiration is willing us to see, is for the closed-minded, the hard-hearted, it's never enough, because you had the sign. Now you have a bunch of fallout from the feeding of the 5,000, the first sign. He then bookends it with another similar sign, and they still say, okay, that's great, but you know, we're going to need something bigger, better. It's never enough.
Yep. And so I think we're going to watch the disciples struggle with this really all the way to the end of the story. It's not really until post-resurrection that you see how vividly these guys. Acts 2 is a sharp contrast to the day after crucifixion, right?
Yeah, Saturday versus that. Saturday versus the first Sunday of the gospel era.
Yes. So it's an interesting piece to add to the story as we go through this. I think as you read this week, pondering the heart would be a really, really healthy exercise. So this isn't just about stories from the life of Jesus, but how they're relevant to us and where we fall in all of that, being, you know, some are hard-hearted, some are all in and thoroughly committed, and some struggle. And the question is, you know, where is my faith, and how utterly convinced am I and committed to Jesus? I think those are good questions to ponder as you work through Matthew 15 this week.